I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The Doxa Documentary Film Festival kicks off tomorrow night with a screening of the new documentary, The Rank and File, The Legacy of a Radical. It's a film that looks back at the larger-than-life Vancouver politician, Harry Rankin. In 1986, after 20 years on Vancouver City Council, the acerbic, brilliant lawyer, a darling of the left and bête noire to everybody else, decides to run for the mayoralty of the city. He's challenged on the center-right by a young developer named Gordon Campbell. During that time, a friend of Rankin's, Peter Smilski, begins filming a documentary about Rankin and the people around him. Because of complications in Rankin's personal life, the film languished in storage. Not too long ago, my guest now, Teresa Alfeld, was able to find the film shot, and she soon decides to catch up with those around the late Harry Rankin's life and look critically at the city that Rankin wanted to change and the city that it's become. It's a fascinating film that emerges. It's a full picture of Rankin in the context of Vancouver's past and recent history, and it's a marvelous chronicle of Vancouver in those post-Expo days and even the city it is today. The film screens tomorrow night, the 3rd of May, as well as on Tuesday, the 8th of May. Visit doxafestival.ca for tickets and information. Teresa Alfeld is a filmmaker and graduate of Simon Fraser University's film production program. She has worked in Vancouver and Toronto as a producer, director, videographer, and editor. Visit therankinfilefilm.com for more information on the film. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Teresa Alfeld. Ms. Alfeld, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I was talking to you before we started. I enjoyed the film a great deal. There's a lot to talk about. I guess the person that we begin with, other than Harry Rankin, which we'll talk about in detail in a moment, is Peter Smilski. Who is he?
Mm-hmm. So Peter Smilski is a lawyer and filmmaker who, back in the early 80s, set out to make a documentary about Harry Rankin. And Peter put together a crew and went and filmed Harry along the campaign trail and just shot reels and reels of glorious, amazing 16mm film of Harry and his contemporaries and of the city really in a glorious time, which was Expo 86. And because of some things going on in Harry's personal life, Peter never ended up finishing the film, and he left the reels in Harry and eventually Phil, Harry's son Phil's basement, and it sat there for a few decades until I was lucky enough to find it. So that's Peter.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing guy.
So we'll talk about how you came across him in a sec, but how much did he shoot? How much film was there?
I believe it was 33 reels of 16 mil. Lots.
Yeah, what does that account for in terms of time?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot here. The time of Peter's stuff, let's say, over an hour.
I see.
Like an hour, maybe an hour and a half. There's some film nerds who will do the conversion perfectly for me. But I can't tell you exactly what the number was. But it was just tons of material, and almost all of it absolutely incredible.
So you got to know Phil Rankin, Harry's son, a few years ago, and I guess that's how you came across the fact that he had this in his basement, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I didn't meet Phil at that time. I'd filmed Phil, excuse me.
I see.
I had recorded Phil speaking at the World Peace Forum years and years back. And he, at that time, was speaking about his experience growing up as a red diaper baby, which was a term I'd never heard before, but essentially describes the experience of kids growing up in either communist or alleged to be communist houses.
Yeah.
And so Phil eventually, a couple years later, approached the company I was working for at that time, Working TV, to sort of help sort through the basement archive devoted to his dad. And I came to really meet Phil when I got the job of going down the basement and starting to look through these boxes and boxes and Rubbermaid containers with material collected over the years about his father, Harry Rankin. Again, a name I'd heard, but I didn't quite know who that was. Go ahead.
Yeah, for a lot of us, I mean, he died in 2002, so for a lot of us today, You know, he's a figure of the past, and mm-hmm. but at the same time, a significant figure in the city's history. And mm-hmm. that must have been fun, seeing all the, because we do see this in the film, all these boxes of stuff mm-hmm. that are in the basement there, this archive, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, as I mentioned, I didn't really know who Harry was. Mm-hmm. I was more just excited. I just finished film school, and I just shot actually a short film on Super 16. So, you know, I've been working with film a lot, and I'm always excited to find it as it, you know, loses popularity as we move into the digital world. But in any event, when I found the film, I was just, A, excited to see what looked like, you know, someone else's project. Mm-hmm. And I asked Phil, you know, what exactly is this? And he said, oh, that's Peter Smilsky's old, you know, incomplete documentary about my dad. So, you know, I was excited about finding the film, but I had no idea just how rich the material was and how significant a film about Harry Rankin could be. You know, if I'd known then, what I know now, I mean, it would have been akin to winning the lottery.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you decide that you want to make this film, The Rankin File, mm-hmm. And I guess you want to use the stuff from 1986 in it, mm-hmm. And the first time you meet Smilsky, what's his reaction to all this?
Peter was great. It took me a while to find Peter. Peter was working in Ukraine in immigration law, mm-hmm. And so it was sort of a process of getting in contact with him and letting him know a bit about myself. Funnily enough, we'd both gone to the same film school, which mm. was nicely a bit of, I think, endorsement for me.
Yeah.
But Peter was incredibly open to the idea and supportive from day one. And I think he really enjoyed the idea of his piece being picked up by someone of a different generation and told now, 30 years later, with a different view and a different eye. So Peter was just, again, a big supporter since day one and just a great guy all around.
He tells you in the film that he's been thinking about it all these years, hasn't he?
I think so.
Yeah. And that's the great part about your film is that you know, we're able to see this. And we're able to see the work of him and all the people, because I watched the credits, a lot of people that helped him along the way there in 1986, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
What, you mentioned a moment ago one of the reasons why he abandoned the project, and that had to do with Rankin's personal life, because in 1986, he had been married for a long time to Johnny, mm-hmm. who was a significant person in his life and in the community, especially mm-hmm. for people with COPE, the party that he belonged to, they belonged mm-hmm. to. Yep. And I guess he leaves her and soon after marries Connie Fogel, who a lot of us know now for her work in terms of globalization or advocacy
mm-hmm.
in that regard. Was that the main reason that Smilsky, ceased the production of his film? Because he didn't want, say, Rankin's life to get out there or the complications of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Peter and I have spoken a lot about the original production. And I'm going to try not to misquote Peter because he's put it really nicely to me. Mm-hmm. Peter felt that he had sort of two options in front of him, that he could either complete a film about Harry that maintained his relationship with Harry, and that film would have to completely exclude any of the personal developments that were going on in his life,
mm-hmm.
And really not explore some of the women in Harry's life, you know, both Johnny and Connie. So he could make that film, which he thought, you know, wouldn't have the integrity and wouldn't hold up, or he could go there and make the more honest, interesting film, but likely sacrifice his relationship with Harry.
Mm.
And so Peter describes making the choice, option three, I guess, which was leave it and walk. And I think it was really hard for Peter. But you know, at the end of the day, we sort of have a happy ending in that I was able to get my hands on it and finish his film and not only honor his original work, but also I think the film is a better film because of the years and years that have passed since Peter shot the original production. I mean, you know, my interview subjects now have decades of, you know, glorious hindsight with which to reflect on that time. So I think we're all pretty happy with the outcome.
Yeah, you're talking about Harry's relationship with women. You interviewed Darlene Marzari in the film, and I guess there's no way to get around it. I mean, Harry was a sexist, but I guess at the same time we have to qualify that he was a product of his era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I think of Harry as a product of his era, I think of Harry more as a product of the 50s. Mm. You know, that Harry really came of age in this post-war working class, socialist political development. You know, Harry had no time for identity politics. I think Harry viewed all struggles as class struggles, and he approached, I think that he certainly lacked a certain sensitivity when it came to working with his colleagues with respect. And, you know, in doing my research before we shot anything, I had been hearing about Harry's, you know, sexist behaviors. And Darlene was the one who wanted to, who was, you know, game enough to go there and talk about her own experience with Harry. So, you know, I think what's so cool about Darlene in the film is she really illustrates that, you know, back in the 70s when she was working with Harry, it wasn't uncommon at all to be treated and spoken to and put down publicly. And I love the way she tells her coffee story about how she was able to take Harry's abuse and spin it and put it back in his face. And I thought that was glorious.
I was shocked. I mean, this tells you where we are and how we've evolved, I guess, in our culture. I was shocked to hear that he asked her to get him a cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm. These are two equals in city council, two elected officials. And
they're called aldermen at the time, too, which is interesting.
Which is a whole other story, yeah. I think I love Darlene, and I think that her willingness to go there in the film was really, really awesome.
Yeah, people need to see the film to see her story and tell what happened in that regard. You interview Gordon Campbell in the film, which is interesting because I had Zussman and Shaw on for their book recently, and they talked to a lot of people about the political stories that they write about, and the one person that they didn't get to talk to was Gordon Campbell. What was it like to talk to him? I guess you had to go to London to talk to him, right?
I had to go to London to talk to Gordon Campbell. Yeah, I hate going to London. Just kidding. It was amazing. it was a trip, you know. When I was writing and developing the doc, I'd always had, you know, and then we interview Gordon Campbell, and he reflects on his campaign against Harry. And I sort of wasn't convinced that it would ever actually happen. Mm-hmm. But Gordon was incredibly game and open and generous with his time and willing to talk about that election back then. And, you know, I think for him, that 86 election was such a small moment in his very long career that he wasn't hesitant to open up and talk about it.
Yeah, that really started Gordon Campbell, that 86 campaign, didn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Campbell says in the film that, you know, he'd had one term on council, and he decided that if he wanted to stay in city politics, he was either going to be mayor or he would return to business. And he ended up becoming mayor, and his political career took off. And, you know, he shares that for him quite casually. And, you know, for me, and I think for a lot of our viewers, it's fascinating to think that had that election gone a different way, the history of this city and really the history of this province would look likely fundamentally different than it does today.
Yeah, and that's the other thing I'm thinking as I'm watching the film. First of all, I'm thinking, you know, what if Harry Rankin had won that election and how different the city would be? But at the same time, the alternative would have been George Pule, say, for mayor, right?
Yeah, I mean, the alternative to Harry being George, I think, yeah, I mean, I don't know how similar George and Gordon really were, even being two members from the right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to imagine. I think that, you know, Harry and George sort of were at a similar place in their political careers, and both sort of had this, you know, long-serving, legendary role within their parties. So it's, in terms of what George would have done, I really don't know. I think that Campbell's, though, was, you know, my sense is that Campbell saw City Hall as the beginning to something much greater, and he always viewed it that way.
Yeah. Did you talk to Peel at all in the course of making this film?
You know, I had a very brief private interview with George, and he was again open and lovely, and he didn't have, you know, he had both kind words and,
yeah,
you know, more realistic words to say about his old sparring buddy. But
yeah,
it was great to talk to George.
Yeah, so this brings up an interesting question that I had in terms of something that I was interested in, I should say. The opponents of Rankin,
mm-hmm,
whether they be Campbell, Puel, Helen Boyce, some of the people, the others, the opponents that we see in the film. I mean,
mm-hmm,
at the end of the day, how did they come to regard him? I mean, fierce battles even with people like Harcourt, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing that really unites everyone who I spoke to about Harry, both his opponents and obviously his supporters, is a sense of respect for his decades-long service.
Mm-hmm.
And for, I mean, Harry, you know, not single-handedly, but Harry was the leading force in changing the political landscape back in 1966, back in, when he broke the monopoly that the NPA had held on council. And through his other work in terms of enfranchisement and getting non-property-owning people the ability to, getting rid of the double vote that people in business had, you know, across the board, people recognize that Harry was a significant figure and made incredible contributions to the city. Even his opponents know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not just the downtown east side, but in terms of renters' rights and the sort, and as we learn in the film,
mm-hmm,
the elections between 66 and 86, I mean, he used to top the polls,
mm-hmm,
and not just in, say, the east end of the city, but throughout the city, right? I mean, Helen Boyce says that she voted for him several times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that scene in the film. I think that she certainly hadn't intended on sharing that, but, you know, she's a woman of integrity and explains, you know, her position. And but you're absolutely right. Harry had support across the city.
Yeah. Someone else we see a lot of in the film is Jack Webster. Not only through the clips of his show, which people can see on YouTube because the
mm-hmm,
Royal BC Museum has uploaded
his
archive. But there is this interview that, well, I don't know if it's an interview, it's a breakfast or a lunch that,
mm-hmm,
that Rankin and Webster have at the old Vic's restaurant that made in Cordova.
Peter Smilsky set that up for his original shoot.
And it's such a fascinating thing because here are these two guys who've known each other obviously a long time.
Yeah.
And are, say, you know, at the near the end of their careers and reflecting on it. And it's such a remarkable piece of film to watch because Webster does mention in one of the clips that this is for posterity. And so did Smilsky tell you anything about how that came about? And I mean, he wanted that for his film, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. He knew that Harry and Jack had a long-standing relationship. And, you know, Jack is one of, I would say, few people who can really hold court with Harry, and who can converse and, trade barbs at the same level as Harry. And so, you know, Smilsky knew that that would really add something to the film, to see these two, you know, sort of heavyweights going back and forth. And I think that was just such an amazing call on Peter's behalf. Sorry, I call them both Peter and Smilsky. Depends on which hat I'm wearing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was such a good idea, and I think that really just speaks to Peter's skill as a filmmaker in crafting these scenes that would allow Harry to really shine, and not only Harry, but again, these two really significant heavyweights to do what they do best. So, credit to Peter.
Yeah, they're both larger than life characters, aren't they? I mean, Rankin especially, and Smilsky tells you in the film that was the challenge of putting Harry in a box, mm-hmm. which I guess is what you filmmakers do, essentially. Mm-hmm. And yet he does that. I mean, we get to know just how important this Uncle Harry is to the city, right?
Yeah. I mean, that is certainly the challenge. I know it was a challenge for Peter, and possibly a bigger challenge for myself, because I didn't know Harry. I'd never met Harry, and it's always an interesting and somewhat strange place to start a documentary about someone who you've never shared a room with. So I think, for me, it was a very different process of getting to learn about all the different facets of Harry's life and everything that he accomplished and all the people who he worked with, and then trying to reduce that to an hour and a half. It is certainly a challenge for me. I think, Peter as well, but Peter had more the structure of the election, whereas I had to start kind of at the beginning.
And what a beginning that was. I mean, the stuff about Rankin's war record and his time during the Second World War. You interview Phil about it, and of course we see the film of mm-hmm. Rankin himself talking about it. We realize that there aren't people of that generation here anymore, and to think that he was of that generation, and yet at the same time, carried it with him, but didn't really wear it publicly, as say right-wing politicians do about their war records, say.
Yep, I think that's totally accurate. I know that Harry was very proud of his service, and most people who were close to him would hear him tell stories of the war and share his pride. But, I think what's so interesting about Harry's war experiences, and this is something that Harry spoke about quite a bit actually in his book, were how they helped shape his fundamental rejection, really, of authority and of the social order and of being told, you are a soldier and you are to behave in a certain way.
Yeah.
Harry saw real combat, and I think that certainly changed him. And that first experience in Jordan River, a great scene in the film, for those who get to see it, was really, I think, the beginning of his political development.
Yeah. What if, because you didn't get to know him or even meet him, what have people who have known him closely, like Phil Rankin, like Connie Fogel, mm-hmm. like Libby Davies, what have they told you about the film?
Oh, about their reactions to
the film? Yeah, I mean, have they seen the Rankin file?
The only one of those was Phil, who has seen the cut. Phil responded well. I think he, like I've said, knows just what a challenge it is to fit this man, this larger-than-life man, in a box. But Phil's reaction has been positive, and the other characters will be seeing the film at Doxa, so I'm going to find out real soon whether or not they respond well. But
I guess they responded well in terms of wanting to talk. I mean, if you can get Gordon Campbell on film to talk about him, I mean, they must have wanted this to happen, right?
Absolutely, and I think it speaks to my earlier point of, everyone who I spoke to who worked with Harry had a massive degree of respect for him, even if they were political opponents. And so it wasn't difficult getting people to speak to me both on and off camera about Harry. It was really just the whole thing has been such a pleasure and so much fun.
That house, I guess it's 3350 or 3370 Hull. Is it still there?
It is currently standing, but there is a proposal for development sign standing outside, as is sort of par for the course in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So it is standing, but probably not too much longer.
And we see in Spilsky's footage, and as well as your film, images of that house. I mean, it's a significant place for Cope and for you know, left wing politics in this town, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was talking to one of Harry's family members who said, you know, I always hoped the Hull Street house would be turned into a left wing think tank after the family was done with it. But you know, I think once again the home was important, and Johnny Rankin was important.
Right.
And that was something that I really wanted to celebrate in the film, was her incredible contribution to Harry's career. You know, she was responsible partly for politicizing Harry to begin with, and then for creating this amazing home and social and activist life for him through throwing these parties, through hosting and inviting activists and politicians to stay in that house, through opening it up to neighborhood kids to stay at when they needed a place to stay. I mean, Johnny Rankin was an absolutely incredible character and a force in her own right. And if I could make a documentary about Johnny, I would absolutely love to do that.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing that I guess Phil says in the film, that after the war and when they meet, she was much more active, wasn't she,
in
politics than he was. And even right up to 86, when they'd already split up, was still very much a part of the campaign there at the headquarters, right?
Absolutely. She was there. She was there in the beginning of COPE, and she was there after the split. And but no, like you said, Johnny had worked in the shipyards and was involved in her union, and was just again an organizer. And again, you know, thinking back to that time, to the 40s and 50s, she was ahead of her time, man. Yeah. She was really incredible.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to watch her, and you just even listen to her talk in the film that Smilski shot, right? A real dame, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, you can hear it in her voice. Yeah. This is a woman who has seen stuff.
Smoked
and
a lot.
Been through it, and smokes and drinks, and, you know, she's a hard-living woman who really got things done and contributed so much to Harry's life and career. It can't be said enough, her role and contribution.
Yeah. So you mentioned before we started that we've got an election in the fall, and it's fascinating to watch your film because we can see Vancouver today and Vancouver as it was, and it's changed a great deal, but it's still familiar to those of us that live here. I keep thinking as I'm watching the film, if Harry Rankin would win today, and you know, we see a little bit of him and in how he's influenced Gene Swanson, who did very well in the recent by-election.
Yes, certainly.
I guess these things come in cycles, and we're back again. The same issues we're still talking about, right?
Yep. I think, you know, One thing that I really enjoyed, one scene that I really enjoyed shooting in the film, was going with Phil down to the seawall and having a look at that, at the north side of False Creek, which, you know, as you'll know from the film, is the backdrop to one of Harry's first big campaign rally speeches.
Right.
And what was a big campaign issue for Harry and Cope. And that was the amount of social housing that was to be required in the development on the Expo land.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in Peter Smilski's footage, you see this, you know, rather undeveloped skyline and, of course, the hilariously weird Expo ride going up and down in the back.
Right, right.
And then, you know, Phil and I went down to the seawall to have a look at the north side and see what exactly had transpired. And, you know, as Phil said, this is essentially the exact opposite of what Harry and Cope were campaigning for. It's a, you know, a collection of very tall, dense glass towers. And I actually did call the city of Vancouver trying to get a figure on what percent of social housing was built on the north side. And I believe it was in and around 11%.
Right.
Remembering that Harry was campaigning for 35, even Gordon Campbell.
He was in the 20s, right?
20. Yeah, he was pushing for 20. And it's the complete opposite of what Harry and Cope were fighting for. And I think it, you know, it says a lot about a city when you prioritize being open for business and you prioritize making money rather than supporting and caring for your citizens. I think that what happened with Falls Creek says a hell of a lot, and I'm hopeful that people are going to see this film and think more about, you know, what choices do we get to make as citizens about the type of city that we want to live in.
Right. Now, as you mentioned, I watched the credits as I finished the film, and I noticed, you know, their crews are obviously your crew and then the crew that Smilski had in 86. Have you talked to any of them other than Smilski in terms of what it's like to now have this film out there again?
Well, luckily, I haven't spoken to them yet. They started reaching out to me. We have a little bit of a social media campaign going online to promote the film. And one individual whose name is escaping me right now wrote on our wall, "Oh, shoot, you know, this is one of the first films I worked on."
Wow.
You know, he's gone on to do other things, but he got his start working on the original documentary. So it's just, I mean, you know, to hear him say, it's so fantastic the film is finally getting finished, even if it's 30 years later. I think it just speaks to the incredible number of people who have contributed to the making of this film over so many years. It's really been, you know, a community project.
Yeah, and well, you've not only made a good movie, Teresa, but you've done a great service because it's a marvelous time capsule, not only of say, 32 years ago or more even, you know, this marvelous council footage from the 70s, the 60s and 70s. Of today, you mentioned the footage that you took of Rankin, Phil Rankin. Just, you know, I shudder to think how different the city will look, say, 5 years from now.
Yeah.
So congratulations on this film.
Thank you so much. And again, just as I said before, it's really been a community effort, you know, from Peter's original work to my producer, John Bolton, who's been an incredible force in getting this film made, as well as all of the subjects who were so game to talk about their experiences with Harry. And, you know, I'm being sincere when I say it's been a community effort and one that I certainly can't take too much credit for. It's been the work of so many people.
So people can see this at Doxa on May 3rd and 8th. After that, I mean, is there life for the film after that?
We certainly hope so. And we're going to be doing everything we can to get the film out on screens and get people watching and learning and appreciating this very uncelebrated part of our history. And, you know, at the end of the day, if it influences people to get a little bit more involved in local politics, then I've done my job.
Now, I hate to ask this, especially since you're promoting your current project, but, I mean, are you working on other things now?
I do. I've got a couple projects in development. One that I'm most excited about is the band that provided the music in the film, Doug and the Slugs, you know, they are also, I would say, an uncelebrated Vancouver story.
Right.
And I got to know some of the band members through getting them to generously give us some music for the film. But I also have a personal connection, having grown up next to Doug, who is the lead singer of Doug and the Slugs. So at the moment, I'm developing a project that looks at their, again, unsung history in the city and contribution to Canadian music at large.
Well, that's something to await, because if it's anything like this film, it's going to be a great one and a necessary one. I so appreciate your time today talking to you, and I urge people to go to Doxa and see this thing.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Joe. It's been a lot of fun.